From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air Weekend. Today, we listen back to my interview with Michael K. Williams. He died Monday. He was 54. He was best known for his roles on The Wire as stick-up man Omar Little and Boardwalk Empire as Chalky White, a bootlegger in Atlantic City during Prohibition. He's nominated for an Emmy for his performance on Lovecraft Country. We talked about how he got his famous scar, how he was using drugs while shooting part of The Wire, and the minister who helped him when he was broken. Also, we hear from U.S. Poet Laureate Joy Harjo, the first Native American appointed to the position. Her new memoir is in part about her family's history and the Trail of Tears. And Maureen Corrigan reviews Sally Rooney's new novel. As one of Michael K. Williams' many fans, I was so sorry to learn on Monday that he'd been found dead in his home earlier that day. Like so many of his fans, I first saw him on the HBO series The Wire, in which he gave a riveting and charismatic performance as Omar Little, a stick-up man who robbed drug dealers who were in no position to complain to the police. He often walked through the streets in a long coat carrying a shotgun. He was feared because he was fearless. What Omar wasn't respected for in the hood was being gay. Williams also co-starred in HBO series Boardwalk Empire as Chalky White, a powerful bootlegger in Atlantic City during Prohibition, and in The Night Of as an inmate who controlled a prison block on Rikers Island. In When They See Us, he played Bobby McRae, the father of Antron McRae, one of five youths wrongfully convicted on charges related to the rape of a woman jogging in Central Park in 1989. Williams is currently nominated for an Emmy for his performance in Lovecraft Country. In a tweet paying tribute to him, his co-star on The Wire, Wendell Pierce, wrote, "He shared with me his secret fears, then stepped out into his acting with true courage." Later, we'll hear the interview I recorded with Michael K. Williams in 2016. We'll start with the interview we recorded in 2008, during the final season of The Wire, which followed the intertwining stories of Baltimore politicians, cops, drug dealers, and the teenagers who sold the drugs on the corners. One turning point in the series was when Omar's boyfriend was murdered, setting off a cycle of retribution. In this scene, Omar, with a gun in each hand, crashes through the door of a card game run by Marlowe, the most powerful drug dealer in West Baltimore.
All right, everybody, let me see them hands, yo. Hands! Hey, yo, big man, back up.
I don't know about cars, but I think these four fives be the full house.
Hey, yo, banker, cash me out, yo. Boy, you want a hit on that body, you best hop too.
That's my money.
Man, money ain't got no owners. Only spenders. I tell you something else. I like that ring, too. Boy, you got me confused when a man repeats himself.
This ain't over.
Well, that's how you carrying the shorty. Huh?
Because I can find your peoples a whole lot easier than they can find me.
Wear it in health.
No doubt.
Michael Williams, welcome to Fresh Air. No, people in the neighborhood are really afraid of Omar because they know what you do. And when the neighborhood kids see Omar coming, they run away screaming, "Omar coming!" How does it feel to have that reaction to you, even if it's only in fiction?
Well, the first time I couldn't get through without laughing. I couldn't fathom anybody would, you know, run away from me in total fear. You know, anybody that really knows me growing up, you know, in Brooklyn knows, you know, that's very far from my character. So I just had a hard time finding a believable state of mind to execute the character. I just kept going to laughter. But, you know, I like to think that people are not scared of him is why they do that. I think it's more of a respect thing. Like, they know that when this dude surfaces, you know, there's going to be gunfire. And I don't think it's necessarily like, oh, my God, Omar's going to kill me. It's like, okay, it's high noon. Let's get the showdown about to happen. Let's get out the way because, you know, stray bullets are, you know, can come this way. So I don't really think, not that they're running from him. They're scared of what what he represents when he comes.
Right.
And they want to get out the way of that.
So you said that anyone who knew you growing up would know that you weren't the kind of person who inspired fear. So how did you find that place in yourself so that you could portray that kind of power?
I play Omar from a very painful place. You know, it's a very dark state of mind to be in, a very painful state of mind. And I identify a lot with him on that level, you know, having overcome a lot of pain in life and stuff. So, you know, Omar, in my book, in my eyes, I don't play Omar as an alpha male. He's not one that would beat on his chest. And he's a very, very sensitive dude. He comes from a very humble place. You know, growing up in the hood, we always knew with the quiet one, the one that would kind of go inside. That's the one you watch out for, you know. So I play him from that aspect.
What's one of the most fearless things that you had to portray Omar doing up until this point in the series? Don't tell us about anything that hasn't happened yet.
I would say the most fearless thing that I was able to pull off and portray as Omar on television was his openness with his sexuality and not have that go over the top. It meant a lot to me that this character be taken seriously by my peers and by my community, and I didn't want this topic of his sexual orientation to hinder his seriousness, and I didn't want to disrespect anybody in the gay community either. So it was like I was I think in a strange way it was okay when it's Omar. You feel me? It's kind of like it was interesting to see that happen. I think it was one of the most challenging parts of his character.
Tell us how you got the part of Omar. Did your agent send them a picture? Like, why were you being
what
considered?
Agent?
Okay.
I was working in my mom's daycare and back in Flatbush. You know, I get a call from Alexa Fogel. She faxed over the breakdown.
Who is she?
Besides, Alexa Fogel's the casting director. You know, before The Wire, did several Law and Orders, did a film with Nicolas Cage, Martin Scorsese, Bringing Out the Dead. I had Sopranos under my belt. You know, I had a few spots that things I had done, but I took a break for like 2 years to work in my mom's daycare in the projects where she raised me at, and I did it for like about a year and 9 months, and decided I wanted to get back into business, and by November I was, you know, putting my stuff back out there. I had a new reel I cut, put it back out there. By March, I got the call for The Wire.
You have a beautiful face, but you also have a scar running down most of the length of your face. How did you get the scar?
Well, first of all, thank you for the compliment. Fighting, barroom brawl, you know, typical New York City story. Wrong place, wrong time, one drink too many. And
what was it about?
I was in a bar, and a friend of mine from Brooklyn was surrounded by a group of guys who they wanted to jump him, and I kind of stuck my nose in it. You know, Brooklyn's in the house. You're not going to get jumped while me and my people's out here. So he ended up going home safe. Nothing happened to him, but I guess the crew gentlemen didn't take too kindly to me, I guess, sticking my nose in their business. So some words were exchanged and tempers got hot, and yeah, some razor blades came out of some mouths. The rest is history.
So initially, how did it change your life? Your life had to change by something as major as that.
Yeah, it definitely was a wake-up call. I almost died that night, though. The scar that most people see is not the one that endangered my life. There's one that goes from my earlobe to my jugular, and that's the one that scared me. I was like, you know, a lot of things would happen. I was, I had two Grand Theft Auto charges, cases, and they were open, I was going to court for, and then this pops up. You know, I was seeing that I was being given an opportunity. You know, I was dancing, I was, you know, modeling and working, getting my little gigs and stuff, and I was happy in the direction that, you know, the universe was taking me as far as, you know, the business was concerned. But I had these little dark situations that would just come up and bite me in my behind. And I think that me getting jumped that night was definitely the pinnacle of that wake-up call. And I just, like, you know, I just I just didn't think I was going to be living very much longer. It was just too many things happening too fast at one time.
So you were already doing acting and modeling when you got cut?
I was dancing more so. I was background dancing a lot.
Like on videos?
Music videos, going on tours and stuff. And I did a spread for this company called Rock Embassy. And it hit all the magazines, all the hip-hop magazines, like Right On and Word Up, those magazines, those publications at the time. Mm-hmm. And they hit the newsstand November 19th, and I got cut November 22nd.
You know, wow.
So my friends had this little joke that they called me the male Marla Gibbs.
What, did you think your career was over?
I never even locked into that. You know, I was pretty much, how am I going to hide this $150 down my face? You know, because I was, you know, club kid era. So I was always like, you know, I always had the flat top and, you know, the loud, trendy shirts. And, you know what I mean? I was a dancer. So that was my MO. So when this happened, I was like, damn, I got to switch it up. So, you know, Seal was really big at the time. And, you know, he had just had all the media for putting his tribal marks on his face. And I was like, that's a great, great angle. I'm going to rock with that. So I bald my head, cut off all my hair, and I was like, I'm the new Seal.
So how did you get into doing music videos? Like, what was your first break there? How did you start dancing in the first place?
I always loved dance. I always, you know, it's the life of the party growing up. But I got into a lot of trouble in my teenage years, you know, messing around the streets, you know, drugs and stuff like that. And I had to go, you know, clear my head for a couple of months upstate. And
you mean like rehab or something?
Yeah. So when I came back from that,
or prison?
I
just, like, I'm not sure what you mean.
it was mandatory. So
right. Okay.
We'll leave it at that. But
sure.
I came back from that, and I was like, you know, I said I'm gonna get my life together. And I was I went to school. Went to BMCC, which is Birmingham Community College. I was taking a business there and got a good job at Pfizer Pharmaceuticals. It was about to make me, I got it like a temp situation. It was about to make me permanent. And man, here goes Janet Jackson dancing her big old butt across my screen talking about Rhythm Nation. I just lost my mind. I just quit school. I quit my job. And I was like, this is it. I'm going to become a Janet Jackson dancer.
My interview with Michael K. Williams was recorded in 2008 during the final season of The Wire. He also co-starred in Boardwalk Empire and is nominated for an Emmy for his performance in Lovecraft Country. Williams died Monday. He was 54. We'll continue our tribute to him after a break with an excerpt of my 2016 interview with him. And Maureen Corrigan will review Sally Rooney's new novel, Beautiful World, Where Are You? I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air Weekend. We're remembering actor Michael K. Williams. He died Monday. He was 54. He became famous for his first major role on The Wire as Omar Little, a stick-up man who robbed drug dealers. He went on to co-star in Boardwalk Empire as Chalky White, a powerful bootlegger in Atlantic City during Prohibition. Williams is currently nominated for an Emmy for his performance in Lovecraft Country. We're going to hear an excerpt of the second interview I recorded with him in 2016 when he was co-starring in the HBO series The Night Of as Freddie, an inmate in Rikers Island, the notorious jail in New York City. When we spoke, he was also hosting a documentary series on Viceland called Black Market about underground economies. The first episode was about carjacking in Newark, New Jersey. You interview a minister, Reverend Ronald Christian, who ran the Christian Love Baptist Church, a church that bordered Newark in Irvington, New Jersey. And
Correct.
This was a church that was really important to you during a difficult period of your life. The episode is dedicated to the memory of this reverend. So in between the time that you recorded the interview and last November when he actually died, I don't know how much time elapsed, but you must have been really shocked. He was found dead on the floor of the church. Does anyone know what happened?
His heart just gave out, man. He got tired. You know, this was a man that, I've never seen someone give so much of themselves 100% night and day. He just never stopped. He was always there in the community, if you're familiar with Essex County, and particularly Irvington and, you know, certain parts of the Oranges and especially Newark, you know that there's a lot of violence that goes on there, a lot of death. Life is very cheap on those streets. And he was always there.
What did he do for you? You came to him during a difficult part of your life.
When I came around, I was
life.
Broken. I came through those doors. I was broken.
When was this?
This was, I would say, around the second, more like third season of The Wire. I was you know, on drugs, basically, keeping it, you know, long story short. And I was in jeopardy of destroying everything that I had worked so hard for. And I came in those doors and I met a man who had never even heard of The Wire, much less watched it. He was somewhere else in the Bronx preaching at another church when I first went there, and he stopped everything he was doing, ran back to New Jersey just because his team at the church told him that some guy named Omar was in trouble and needed to speak to him. And he came in his office and he says, write your full name down and your email. He said, I'm going to go get you a Bible, man. You could keep that and we're going to spend the rest of this day. And I was like, bet. So I wrote my full name down, Michael Kenneth Williams. And as he's leaving the office, he turns around and says, so what you want to be called, man? I said, well, you know, my name is Michael, but, you know, I could do Mike, you know. He said, but why everybody saying Omar in trouble? And I was like, oh, this dude, that clueless and had nothing to do with Hollywood light or who I was in my job. Some human being, just basic human being stuff. And he and I have been joined at the hip ever since. One of his biggest sayings was, I'm going to love you till you learn to love yourself. And he never judged. He never, you know, just nudged. You know, Mike, you know, if you want to stop this pain, I can help you with this. But until you're ready, man, I'm your brother. He never, you know, I'm not saying he accepted me in my dysfunctionalism, but he loved me in it. And it worked. It worked for me. It got me to want to become a grown man, to grow up and to stop acting foolish, or at least to make the attempt to stop acting foolish, you know.
He went from prison guard to prisoner to reverend. So I assume there was some kind of like religious transformation along the way. Was there a religious transformation in your life? Did that figure into your life at all?
Yeah, it was more of a spiritual awakening than anything religious. Mm-hmm. You know, that was the first time I actually walked into a church and felt like it's okay. I didn't feel dirty. You know, I come from there's a lot of things in my past, some that I did, some that happened to me that you know, caused, you know, a lot of scars. You know, one was, you know, the molestation that went on in my life early on. I'm a survivor of that.
How old were you?
12 or 13, 12, somewhere up in there. You know, things happen.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, you move on and I never would go into church. I always felt like, you know, with the whole, it made me question myself on every level. You know, those events happening so early on in my life. And I would go to church with this, like, you know, this secret, this weight. Like, you know, I'm dirty. I'm dirty. God is never going to want me. I'm dirty, you know. You know, and then, you know, you mix that with the whole, you know, dark skin just became popular. I had a very low self-esteem coming up, and I just never felt like God loved me because I was dirty, because, you know, I was damaged goods for whatever reasons, whatever that means, you know. And I wore that badge very early on in my life, and I didn't let that go until I walked into Christian Love Baptist Church. You know, I saw other men who said, yeah, me too, out loud, you know. Yeah, and it doesn't make you less of a man. It doesn't make you dirty, you know. You know, how to forgive myself and how to forgive people, move on. I got all of that in Christian Love, you know.
You know, in our first interview, you talked about how when you were playing Omar, it was hard for you to summon up the kind of power that he had. I mean, he was a stick-up man. He used to hold up drug dealers and steal their money. He didn't approve of drugs. He didn't like dealers. So he'd take their money and have no qualms about it. And he was tough enough and brave enough to do it. So you said that you never thought of yourself as having that kind of power. You know, in fact, the opposite. And so the thought of you playing that role made you laugh. And you even told me that in the first scenes that you played, you couldn't stop laughing because you thought it was so absurd to for you to be
wow, Terry, you
playing
got a great
somebody
memory.
With that kind of power. So
it was the scene when we was walking down the aisle and they, Omar come and drop the drugs out the window. And he turns his back. I'm like, no one in their right mind who knows me. I said, it's over now. We're going to ruin this character because people are going to go out there. They're going to say, that's not real. We know Mike. Mike is not that. And it was like, you know. And so for me to connect, you know, again, the whole alpha male aspect, I don't know how to. I'm sorry.
I feel like maybe I understand a little bit more what you were saying. Like, if you were molested, I could understand how you would feel like you didn't have that kind of physical power.
Yeah, I never felt like that. And, you know, I just wasn't raised to have that violent side. So it kind of...
Or to be physically intimidating.
Yeah.
You're laughing.
I don't have that.
Yeah, right.
I don't have that. It wasn't accepted in my mom's household to fight. That just was not the case. And mm-hmm. and so I just didn't have that skill. But the anger, the emotions, I didn't know what to do with those when people would, you know, create those emotions in me. What do I do with that? And so as a result, I ended up hurting myself a lot, you know. You know, a lot of my anger was turned inward on me. And that's where the drug addiction came from, basically.
So why do you think you started using drugs started using them again, I'm not sure which, after The Wire was on, after you'd become successful? Because you'd think on the surface that would be a period when your self-esteem would be, like, really good because you were so great in the role and people, like, loved you in it.
Yeah, see, that's the trick. That's the trick. It can't be anything outward that makes you feel good about yourself. That is the trick. Those things don't work. Feeling good, that's got to come. It's got to come from the inside out, not the outside in. And, you know,
Or you didn't feel worthy?
No. Hell no, I didn't feel worthy of opportunity like that. And then, you know, when I was given this character as Omar, I could have used it as a nurturing tool for myself. It could have been cathartic for me. I decided to wear it as a Spider-Man suit, you know, and just fly around. Wee, look at me. I got web in my hands, you know. And instead of actually doing the work and finding out how I could, you know, use this character to make myself feel better about me, I used it instead of me. It was, it was like my crutch. And so when The Wire and the character of Omar ended, I had zero tools, personally speaking, and how to deal with letting that go. I wasn't going around robbing people or anything stupid like that, but I definitely wore that dark energy that Omar was. He was a dark soul, tortured soul, and I just woke all of that up and lived in that. So, and that's what people was attracted to. His whatever they were attracted to, I just didn't know how to differentiate. Okay, that is Omar's love, and then you have Michael's love. The lines got blurred. A little too close to the white meat at the time. It's old figure of speech in the streets.
Okay.
When you cut somebody to the white meat. It was a little too close to home, that character. And I didn't equip myself with the tools of how to wash that off my psyche.
It's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much. And thank you for all the great work you've done.
Thank you, Terry. Thanks for your time.
My interview with Michael K. Williams was recorded in 2016. He died Monday at the age of 54. When our book critic Maureen Corrigan reviewed Irish writer Sally Rooney's second novel, Normal People, in 2019, she said that even if Rooney were to write a novel about bath mats, it would be worth reading. Fortunately, Rooney's latest novel, called Beautiful World, Where Are You?, is about much more. Here's Maureen's review.
Sally Rooney's breathlessly anticipated new novel, called Beautiful World, Where Are You?, features four characters who, among other things, ruminate over whether there's any value to breathlessly anticipated new novels in this age of pandemic and climate change. It's a testament to Rooney's curious, cerebral gifts as a writer that she not only draws her readers into tolerating long stretches of such ruminations, but makes them so entertaining we feel we're in good company with our own end-time anxieties. Rooney's plaintive title, Beautiful World, Where Are You?, is from a late 18th century poem suffused with grim nostalgia yet desperate hope by the German romantic writer Friedrich Schiller. It's a question that her characters figuratively keep asking themselves, "Beautiful world, where are you?" As in Normal People, her 2018 novel that was made into a Hulu TV series, Rooney focuses on romance, sex, work and its dissatisfactions, and the vast chasms of opportunity that divide different social classes. But because the characters here are a bit older, and the world, even in the space of 3 short years since Rooney's last novel, has become much more frightening, there's also a cosmic dimension to her title question. In other words, will there be a beautiful world left for any of us? When we first meet her, Alice thinks not. She's waiting at a hotel bar in the west of Ireland for a man she's connected with on Tinder. But having recently suffered a nervous breakdown, Alice is emotionally tamped down to the point where her expectations are minimal. The other thing to know about Alice is that she's an internationally best-selling 29-year-old novelist who loathes her own celebrity. Reflecting on interviews she's given, Alice says, "I keep encountering this person who is myself, and I hate her with all my energy. I hate her appearance, and I hate her opinions about everything. And yet, when other people read about her, they believe that she is me." Though I know I'm falling into a trap Rooney has set for the critically unsophisticated, I must point out that Alice sounds an awful lot like Rooney herself, who's talked in interviews about her own discomfort with fame. The person Alice is waiting for turns out to be an angry young man named Felix, who works in a warehouse. "You must think you're very special," sneers Felix early in their relationship. His resentment fuels a fair amount of hostile sex, one of Rooney's other signatures as a novelist. The quartet is rounded out by Alice's best friend from college, Eileen, who's the least guarded and most psychologically astute of the group. She toils as an editor for a small literary magazine. And then there's Simon, a charming political functionary. Simon and Eileen are childhood friends who've been intermittently sexually involved, but they keep each other at a distance to preserve their friendship. Rooney vividly traces the shifting, amoeba-like shapes of these relationships in her distinctive, expository prose style that reads like a late capitalist homage to Hemingway. For instance, 2 sentences here detail how Eileen removes and disposes of the cling film on her microwave dinner. But in this ambitious novel of sentiment and ideas, which is so up to the minute in its global concerns, Rooney ironically reaches back to one of the oldest forms of the novel, the epistolary or letter form, to tell her story. Long emails and texts, mostly between Alice and Eileen, contemplate not only their muddled romantic relationships, but also liken the general systems collapse of the late Bronze Age to the political and climate disasters of the present. At one point, Alice writes to Eileen about her terrific crush on Felix and wraps up by saying, "So, of course, in the midst of everything, the state of the world being what it is, humanity on the cusp of extinction, here I am writing another email about sex and friendship. What else is there to live for?" It's striking that in this, Rooney's toughest and most sweeping novel to date, that what's tentatively affirmed at the end are exactly the things Alice has mentioned in that letter. Sex and friendship, personal bonds between human beings. Yet the frequently unbeautiful world beckons, demands the character's engagement, even as they flinch from it. Rooney's novel, like all great fiction, is open-ended. It's given to an ambivalence that runs from the author through her narrative to us readers. Are we really, as Schiller writes, left only with word deprived of soul? Rooney isn't sure. Instead, she entices us into her own dark uncertainty, where remarkably, we enjoy spending time.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Sally Rooney's new novel, Beautiful World, Where Are You? Coming up, we hear from U.S. Poet Laureate Joy Harjo. She's the first Native American appointed to the position. She has a new memoir. This is Fresh Air Weekend.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Teladoc. Teladoc offers access to licensed therapists by phone or video for help with depression, anxiety, stress, and more. You're able to choose the right therapist or psychiatrist for your needs and schedule a visit 7 days a week from wherever you feel comfortable. 92% of people who have used Teladoc saw an improvement in their mental health. Download the app or visit teladoc.com/freshair today to get started. This message comes from NPR sponsor Total Wireless, which helps you stay connected and turn your experiences from good to amazing with the best devices, network, and savings. When you move to Total Wireless, you can get an unlimited plan starting at $25 a month that includes 5G, available in 2,700-plus cities, capable device and SIM required. Terms and conditions at TotalWireless.com.
My guest, Joy Harjo, is the first Native American to be appointed Poet Laureate of the U.S., and she's only the second Poet Laureate to be appointed to a third term, the term she's now serving. Her new memoir, Poet Warrior, is a personal story, including how she learned to find herself in the spiritual world. It's also the story of how her family connects to the history of Native people in America. She writes about her great-grandfather, who survived the Trail of Tears, the government-enforced relocation to what was designated as Indian Territory. That's how her family wound up in Oklahoma. Harjo is a member of the Muscogee Creek Nation and lives in Tulsa. In addition to her own collections of poems, she edited the books When the Light of the World Was Subdued, Our Songs Came Through, a Norton anthology of Native Nations poetry, and Living Nations, Living Words, an anthology of First Peoples poetry. At the age of 40, Harjo started playing saxophone. She plays and recites her poems on her new album, I Pray for My Enemies. Joy Harjo, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
I just want to start with a language question. I use the expression Native American. In your book, you say that you don't really like that expression, but I asked you about it beforehand, and you said you're kind of with it now. You're changing your mind. So tell us what words you like to use to describe your heritage and why you have that preference or those preferences.
Well, I grew up with the term Indians or American Indians, and of course, that's problematic too. And Native American came out of the academic realm somewhere in the 80s. And for me, I've settled on just Native with the capital N, or sometimes I use Indigenous or even, you know, First Peoples.
But you said it was okay to use Native American. Explain why you're okay with that.
It's become ubiquitous, and even the younger people are using that term. Although among ourselves, we call each other by our tribal nations' names.
It sounds from your memoir like a real turning point for you as a person and as a poet was the Native empowerment movement of the 60s. What were the issues that you were fighting for then?
The 60s, I equate a lot with, you know, civil rights. You know, it was a humanity alert that this country is huge. There's more of us and not everyone has equal rights. In the late 60s, I was at Indian boarding school in Santa Fe, New Mexico, not your usual boarding school, but it was an arts school. And I remember hearing about Martin Luther King being killed, and all of that was on the news. And we were all young Native artists there from 8th grade to 2 years postgraduate. We'd stay up late nights talking and making art together and talking about what it meant to be a Native person and about history and about how our art was part of history making.
And did you become an activist?
Yes, I think I always was in some way, you know, is that I think what I've come to realize and that what has motivated my art making is really a strong need for justice, for people to be treated, for everyone. And when I say people, I also mean animals and insects and the birds and the earth person that we are all part of, that there's a key element, and that's respect. And, you know, when I became more actively involved as a student at the University of New Mexico, I was painting then and just starting to write poetry. And I remember thinking, if my work does nothing else, when I get to the end of my life, I want Native peoples to be seen as human beings.
Were there specific issues related to sovereignty or equal rights that you were fighting for then?
I remember sitting as a young person, as a student, sitting in on meetings with coal companies, uranium companies in the Southwest, with Native peoples attempting to get a voice in or attempting to turn the story towards respect for the earth, or respect for the people, to take care of, you know, the quality of water, the quality of people's lives. And I remember at one point going out to do a story at just after the Church Rock uranium spill, and there were children out playing in the water and the livestock, and the Navajo speakers were saying, "What we need a word. I mean, how do we come up with a word that will tell the people that even though you can't see it, there is something dangerous here that can harm you, and you can't use these waters," when it was the only source of water for their livestock.
I'd like you to read a poem that I think relates to what we're talking about. And it's in your new memoir, and it doesn't really have a title. It's just kind of integrated into the text. And the first line is, "Poet warrior reached for a gun."
Okay, here goes. "Poet warrior reached for a gun. She was given a paintbrush, a saxophone, a pen. 'These will be your instruments of power,' the old one said. Though the gun gleamed and pranced as a tool of takeover by governments, even as it danced through the imaginations of revolutionaries as the perfect tool for social change. 'Do not be fooled,' they told her. 'Violence might be louder, tougher, and is often good-looking. The power of insight and compassion is fiercely humble and helpful. Be ready for what the story of your age demands. You will be tested. There will be jealousy, envy, but the most difficult enemies will be from your closest circle, even your family. You must act in a manner that will cause no harm to anyone, 7 generations back or forward."
That's my guest, Joy Harjo, reading a poem from her new memoir, Poet Warrior. So you've been a tribal member of the Muscogee tribe since birth. What does it mean to, like, officially be a tribal member?
Well, yeah, that becomes a very hot political subject, because there are federally recognized tribal groups and tribal nations in this country. There are tribal nations that are legitimate, that are not federally recognized. There are many fake tribal entities that are trying to claim tribal status for a number of reasons. So there's something certainly about belonging. And, you know, it's like any family. I think for me, let me just put it here. You know, I belong to a family, and this is my family.
Native tradition is an oral tradition, not a written tradition. How did you become absorbed in books and poems and language? And did you have people to share that love with?
I've been trying to think of the first time I encountered reading or books, because the only book we had in our house, I think, was the Bible. And I like the pictures. You know, often there were pictures in those books, or at least the one we had. And when I went to first grade, when we started to learn how to read, I was so thrilled about what happened with symbols, and that suddenly it opened up a world to me. I could read. I read all of the books in the first grade classroom and was sent into the second grade and it became like a hunger for me. But I like the sounds, of course. I like the sound that words make. I like the percussion, the percussive elements, and the images, and so on. Just like, you know, I heard the same kind of thing I heard in my mother's song making. But the more I read and the more the ability grew, the deeper I could read, the more stories. And I could be transported in much the same way that I could be in that kind of visionary dream world when I was younger. And when we get to about 7, and I think this happens to a lot of us, we forsake those realms of knowing and understanding, and reading helped give that back.
Your mother wrote some songs, words and music?
Yes, she did. She wrote, when I was really young, she was still with my father, she was writing songs. So she was so in love with him. And they were ballads, and a lot of them were very sad, but they were so beautiful. And she was going in and recording demos. And the band leader, a very famous band leader here, Ernie Fields, took one of her songs and arranged it into a orchestral piece. But she loved music, and she had an old Underwood typewriter that was the most intriguing thing in the house that we were supposed to stay away from. But it was, you know, it could make words. And that all stopped when they divorced. But there was a moment when we were immersed in music in our home.
You grew up in violent homes. Your father was abusive to you and your mother. He was also very attractive and charismatic and seemed to know it and cheated on your mother. Then you had a white stepfather who was maybe even more abusive. He forced your mother to play Russian roulette while your younger siblings watched. You weren't there at the time. You know, after growing up in a violent home, you wrote, "I made the decision that I would be different. I would make my own life free of marriage, of violence, and the dominance of the belief system that demands that women must have a husband and children to be happy. I hadn't seen that happiness at home or in many of the homes around me." So you had this will to break away and to be different, to be independent, to not depend on a man or children to be happy. But you had a child when you were 17. So what did you do when you were 17 and pregnant? And then were you still 17 when you gave birth, or 18? I'm not sure if there's a big difference one way or the other. Yeah, so were you still in school?
No, I graduated from high school a year early because I had enough credits from the Institute of American Indian Arts, and I had just been in one of the first all-Native drama and dance troupes, and we performed in some big theaters in the Pacific Northwest and different Native communities, and I came back pregnant, no one knew, and then got on a bus and showed up to the bait where the baby's father lived, and he miraculously met the bus, and I lived with some friends of his on a couch, and then lived with him and his mother and his grandmother. And I didn't know how I was going to get through that or get out of it, because I had no means, I had no escape route, really, and I was just trying to make the best of it.
How did you get out of that?
We moved out of Oklahoma, moved back to New Mexico.
We being who? You?
My son's father, my then husband, and my son and his daughter, my stepdaughter. We moved back to New Mexico, and there I was again in that circle of other Native artists. And that lifted my spirits because I had community there.
I'm sure a lot of people were telling you, that's all very nice, but you have to make some money, and you're not going to be able to support your children by making beautiful things or writing poetry.
Yeah, definitely. It's like, well, the art that people could understand, you know, there's artists. I come from a family, my aunt, my grandmother, Naomi Harjo, Aunt Lois Harjo, they were artists. They made paintings, oil paintings, they made real art. And in Oklahoma growing up, a lot of Native artists all around. But when I went to poetry as undergrad at the University of New Mexico, when I went to poetry as my major, No one. I got no encouragement except from the poetry teachers, you know, that I was a good poet, but nobody would support. Nobody wanted to support poetry, and people were concerned because, you know, how are you going to make a living? And there was a push at that time. We had a tremendous push for Native peoples to gain degrees in law, in medicine, in the medical fields, in education, in economics, because there was a great need. There's, you know, a great need of people to fulfill those roles. But what role does a poet have?
You considered becoming a doctor. You went to med school and dropped out pretty quickly because you didn't feel prepared for all the heavy-duty science.
Right. I was pre-med when I entered the University of New Mexico with a minor in dance. But so there you go.
You are serving your third term now as Poet Laureate of the United States. Were there any clues along the way that something like that would happen to you?
I didn't know exactly where it was going to lead, but I knew it was the direction in which I needed to go. And along the way, there were years that there was no recognition, that what I published or did didn't seem to make a difference. But I followed because it, for me, it made the path kept opening and opening and opening. And so to become the U.S. Poet Laureate is quite an honor. But I had no idea. I had no idea that it would come to that.
I want to turn the subject to music and poetry. You started playing saxophone when you were 40, which, you know, is considered like really late to start to learn an instrument. Did you make your peace when you started playing saxophone, knowing that things wouldn't be as kind of automatic for you as for people who learned as children, where, like, you know, like the chords and the keys, it just becomes second nature because you're learning it when your brain is being formed?
Yes, it was. You know, I played clarinet a couple of years when I was younger.
Oh, so you had some of the basics.
I had some basics, and we were lucky that we had music. We had music and art in elementary school here in Tulsa, at least, you know, in those years. So I had some music background. I walked away from music because around the same time I stopped singing because one, the band teacher wouldn't let girls play saxophone, so I left band. And around the same time, my stepfather would not allow me to sing in the house. And
why?
He didn't want, you know, because I think it represented happiness. And I did it in my room, closed the door, listening to Columbia House Records that I subscribed to. But, you know, it represented, my mother didn't sing. You know, my mother was a singer and songwriter, and she wasn't allowed to sing either. Nor did she feel like singing. It was almost as if he had locked up all the, you know, a bird family in a house and forbid us to sing.
That is so sad.
So I left it all behind, and it wasn't until I was almost 40 that I got a band together, and I started fooling around on a saxophone. I learned the G blues scale and slowly started playing and got an all-native band together, mostly native musicians who were also attorneys, and we started the Poetic Justice. That's the name. We started a band called Joy Harjo and Poetic Justice, and that was the beginning of it.
Joy Harjo, thank you so much for talking with us, and stay well.
Yeah, well, thank you so much.
Joy Harjo's new memoir is called Poet Warrior. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Thea Challoner, Seth Kelly, and Kayla Lattimore. Our digital media producer is Molly C.V. Nesper. I'm Terry Gross.